You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Iram Alam, an assistant professor in the History of Science Department at Harvard University. Dr. Alam is a specialist in the history of medicine, focusing on the complex intersections of race, migration, and U.S. healthcare. She's the author of a new book, The Care of Foreigners: How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare. It explores the fascinating and often overlooked history of how the United States came to rely on a global workforce of physicians to sustain its medical system. Today, we'll be discussing how thousands of doctors from post-colonial nations like India, Pakistan, and the Philippines became the backbone of American healthcare during times of national crisis and the bureaucratic hurdles they faced to be recognized as qualified. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Dr. Alam.
Thank you so much, Mike.
So I want to start with an assessment. Can you tell me about the current population of foreign physicians compared to U.S.-born populations and the trends that you're witnessing?
Yeah, I definitely can. So for the last 60 years, at least a quarter of the U.S. physician labor force has been comprised of immigrant physicians. And these physicians, like you mentioned, come from India, Pakistan, the Philippines, and now Nigeria is also amongst the largest sending countries to the United States. And these physicians come to the country and they work in what are called shortage areas throughout the United States. So these are communities that don't have an adequate number of physicians in relation to their population. And generally, they're located in urban and rural areas where there are community hospitals, public safety net hospitals, public hospitals, and the immigrant physicians who are working there are generally in specialties that are considered to be the least lucrative. So they work in internal medicine, in pediatrics, in family medicine, in geriatrics. And so they're really on the front lines of the US healthcare system. They're working with the most vulnerable patients, and they're doing the triage work that's necessary to sustain the health of the United States.
So as you say, they're on the front lines, and they're doing this necessary work in the rural regions. Why rural regions?
Well, rural regions have historically been less attractive to U.S. graduates to go and work and to settle in. The pay is less, the sometimes quality of life is not exactly what a U.S.-trained medical graduate wants. If they're in cities, they have often better opportunities, different kinds of fellowship possibilities to advance their careers. Often training in rural communities doesn't have high specialization, so you won't find cutting-edge cardiothoracic surgery often in a rural hospital. And so what happens is that the physicians who come from elsewhere, they can come and find work in these rural hospitals.
Well, your book talks about colonial history that fundamentally shaped modern medical migration by establishing the infrastructure, the language, educational standards, all of those things that allow physicians from the global south to be, quote, legible and transposable within Western medical systems. Talk about the British colonization of South Asia and the U.S. colonization of the Philippine Islands.
So central to this program of colonization was the establishment of these biomedical institutions. So these colonial, whether it's the U.S. or the British, they really thought that if they established these kinds of institutions, that they could disseminate a certain kind of biomedical knowledge, and that this was essential for disciplining bodies and disciplining populations. And of course, they thought that they were doing a good thing, and maybe they were, but it was really with the logic that we need to do this in order to improve these people because they're backward and they're deficient. So they established all of these kinds of institutions to train physicians, to train nurses in the Philippines. This was a huge, huge investment there. And with that, they instituted the Western models of education. And with both the Philippines and the United States, English became the predominant language of instruction. And so the legacies of these institutions after the colonizers left was that these institutions remained, the infrastructure that they helped to build also was in place, and English continued to be the language of instruction. And so this became really, really useful because when you're wanting to get people to come from elsewhere, when you're starting from a place of the fact that you can recognize the systems that they were trained in, they have this language ability, the ease of incorporating them into the colony is much easier. So this is why I think you don't see as many Chinese physicians, for example, come to the United States as you see from these particular nations.
Well, that makes sense. So let's take a look back at the historical record. Tell me about the Hart-Celler Act of 1965.
So the Hart-Celler Act was this really key piece of legislation that changed the whole composition of the U.S. healthcare labor force. Prior to 1965, the United States had a very closed, restrictionist immigration policy, which consisted of two major components. And one was called the National Origins Act, which really restricted immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. And the other was called the Asian Exclusion Act, which is exactly what it sounds like. And so it prohibited any immigration from Asia or Africa to the United States. So then fast forward now to 1965, the United States has emerged as this global leader. We're in the middle of the Cold War, and the United States is trying to make sure that these newly emergent post-colonial nations don't get seduced by the communist sphere of influence, because they're vying for these countries to make sure that they can keep them in the capitalist orbit of the capitalist sphere of influence. So immigration policy becomes this really important tool to signal to these countries that, hey, we want to be friends with you, because if we open up immigration to you, that means that we want movement from these countries. That's one really important thing on the geopolitical level. And then simultaneously, what was happening in the United States is there was a shortage of skilled physicians, scientists, and engineers. So for my work, the physicians are the key. And we have the World War II post-baby boom that's happening. We have just also a different sensibility that's emerging in the United States with the civil rights, where people are starting to assert their right to healthcare as part of that kind of political campaign. And then in July of 1965, Medicare and Medicaid passed. So Medicare is federally funded insurance for people that are over 65, and Medicaid is federally funded insurance for people who are low income. So overnight, you have these shifts that are happening, and at least 23 to 25 million people automatically enter the labor force with Medicare and Medicaid. And then in October of 1965, Hart-Celler passes. And there's this special stipulation there where the quote is something along the lines of, aliens who are seeking to enter the United States for the purposes of skilled labor when there's a shortage can have expedited entry. So these pieces came together where the U.S. is trying to attract people from these specific countries. It has a domestic shortage. And so a foreign expert who has this skill set is allowed very, very speedy entry into the United States. From then on, 1965, this huge influx of immigrant physicians who end up coming, and sometimes they constitute anywhere from 25 to 46% of the U.S. labor force.
That's quite a large chunk. My guest is Dr. Iram Alam, assistant professor in the History of Science Department at Harvard University. She's the author of The Care of Foreigners, How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare. Dr. Alam, I want to introduce you to two prominent local doctors who have been practicing here in Southern Oregon over the past 20 years, Dr. Som Ghosh and Dr. Mujahid Rizvi. Let's listen to their introduction.
I was born in the city of Pune. That's a few hours south of Bombay. That's where I went to med school. And I came to the United States in 2002. I did my master's in molecular biology at the University of Cincinnati, followed by a residency in internal medicine in Baltimore, and then a fellowship in pulmonary and critical care in Houston. I moved to Medford in 2011, and I've been here ever since.
Dr. Rizvi.
So mine's a little bit more complicated. My parents are originally from Pakistan. They moved to England in the 60s, so I was born in England. My dad and my mom both always wanted to go back to Pakistan. So when I was 12, we moved back to Pakistan. So I finished my schooling, ended up going to medical school there, and then ended up coming to the States. I spent 2 years in Oklahoma City at the University of Oklahoma. I did a research fellowship in hematology there. there. Also got my master's in public health. And then I moved to the University of Florida for my internal medicine residency, and then moved to Chicago to Northwestern University to do my fellowship in hematology oncology. I moved to Medford in 2006, so almost 20 years ago.
So you'll notice that in addition to their expertise in medicine, they both have a masterful command of the English language. And we'll hear from them again a little later in this interview. Can you tell me, Dr. Alam, what is the ECFMG exam?
The ECFMG stands for the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates. And it was this organization that started in the 1950s and the 1960s to really contend with this question of immigrant physicians that were coming to the United States. So the idea was, this organization was tasked with figuring out, how do you create some kind of standard system or route or protocol for all of these physicians that are coming from all over the world? So how do you decide that somebody who has training in South Korea, somebody who has a degree from South Africa, somebody who has a degree from the United States, and somebody that has a degree from India have some, what are the shared similarities? How do you create some kind of commensurability across all of this vast difference? So the ECFMG was established to kind of manage and figure out how to streamline the whole entire process. And one of the first steps that they took was to institute a 350 multiple choice exam around biomedical knowledge for all of these physicians to take, and an English language competency component as well. And so for any immigrant physician that wanted to come to the United States, the first thing that they had to do was to take this exam and to pass this exam that was administered by the ECFMG. And after they did that, then they could figure out what the next steps were going to be. More recently, the ECFMG really has become even stronger in terms of the work that they do to manage the physician labor flow. So now they do a lot of the visa, if not all of the visa sponsorship work for the physicians that are currently arriving.
So in your book, you describe this exam as a way to restructure global medical knowledge into a U.S.-centric framework, sort of an assimilation into American way of healthcare. Why did some physicians feel that the multiple choice format and the questions themselves felt like some sort of trick?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So, you know, I don't know if you remember from your time of multiple choice, but so much of it, I remember studying for the ACT or the SAT, so much of it is about strategy of how certain questions are written and how, you know, okay, if the previous answers are C, then the next ones won't be, and thinking through the actual structure of the test rather than the content of what's being asked. So in India, in Pakistan, the way that people were assessed was in a really different kind of manner. So they weren't asked questions like, all of these, what is the probability of patients that are Black having typhoid, for example? First of all, they didn't have a concept of what that meant, of what does it mean to be Black, which is, of course, a very contested category always, and what that means even now is uncertain. But when you ask people who have not been in that racial milieu to start thinking in those terms, what they're doing more often than not is trying to game the question instead of really thinking through what that means. Because the way that they were trained to think about typhoid, for example, was to think about the signs or the symptoms that would affect everybody, and that they didn't have these kinds of probabilistic or these race-based kind of categories of, okay, this group has a larger percentage of getting, a higher percentage, excuse me, of getting this disease than another group. And so to do that work of having to situate your knowledge within this racial landscape was very confusing to these physicians, because also they're studying for this exam, they're taking this exam even prior to entering into the country. And so many of them that I interviewed in for the project, they would say, I've never seen a Black person. I don't know what this means. You know, I've never taken care of a white person. In fact, even I've been trained, I've worked in this place with Indian communities who have different ways of grouping and categorizing people. And so those were the shorthands that they would use to do their medical work. And so to translate that over was quite challenging for them.
That sounds quite interesting because they have to figure out how to assimilate into our system, which is rooted in the ideology of racial hierarchy and white supremacy. We'll have to take a short break on that note. I'll be back shortly with my guest, Dr. Iram Alam, assistant professor in the History of Science Department at Harvard University and author of The Care of Foreigners, How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. Welcome back to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Iram Alam. She's an assistant professor in the History of Science Department at Harvard University and author of The Care of Foreigners, How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare. Dr. Alam, what is bureaucratic determinism?
It's this idea that bureaucracy is absolutely essential in determining the outcome for people's lives. So in the case of immigrant physicians, there was all of this uncertainty that you asked about earlier. And how does one know about these figures that are from elsewhere who are coming into the United States? And how can you trust them? Because this is not just a interaction. A clinical interaction is not just a regular trust interaction. It's an extremely vulnerable, intimate kind of trust interaction. And so what happened was that there was this whole infrastructure of paper, I argue, that was really, really designed to contend with the anxiety around this difference and the unknowability of these practitioners who were coming from abroad. How do you know who these people are? How do you know that they're not faking their credentials and that they actually know what they say that they know? And will they be able to treat you in the ways that they say that they can? And so this idea was that bureaucracy becomes so, so essential in trying to assert some kind of control over all of this vast kind of difference. And, you know, I don't think it's a mistake that this language of undocumented causes so much anxiety, because the document, whether it's the passport, whether it's the real ID, these become such vital mechanisms for not only, okay, this is some kind of identification, but they're a way of rooting somebody in a whole entire social political network and of stabilizing their identity. And so with these physicians, they're again coming from elsewhere. They're saying that we're doctors. They're saying we're going to do, you know, the most intimate kinds of things to you. And so it became this route through which I argue that a lot of this anxiety around who these strangers were really was routed.
You share a story about a physician whose application for hospital privileges was denied because his initials did not match U.S. bureaucratic norms. How do these norms and forms serve to destabilize an immigrant's sense of belonging?
Yeah, so the physician you were talking about, he had trained in Bangalore, which is a city in southern India, and had been in the United States for about 7 or 8 years and was practicing. And he wanted to move from Colorado, I believe it was, to Illinois to start a private practice. And in order for a physician who has a private practice, they have to have an affiliation with the hospital so that if they say to their patient, you need to go get a CT scan, they have a place that they can go to get that CT scan. So this physician, he applied to a local hospital. He submitted all of his paperwork to ask for privileges. And the director of the hospital denied him his access. And so the doctor wrote him and asked him, why was I denied? And the director came back and he said, well, it was because your name was written incorrectly on the forms. And your transcripts from India, which, remember, he's already been working in the United States for 8 years. So transcripts that dated at least 13 to 15 years prior, the medical school that he attended in India was not able to mail them, or there was some discrepancy in some document delivery that the hospital wanted in order to grant privileges. And so this physician was extremely upset about getting this negative reply. And he included a letter. He included these documents from National Geographic to explain to the director that these are just different naming practices. This is not some kind of sleight of hand that I'm trying to do where I'm somebody who's trying to be somebody else, where my name is not filling the spaces that it should, that this is just the way of naming in the part of the region in India that I'm from. And in addition, he included all of these additional letters of reference, essentially from his US trained colleagues that said, this is a really good doctor. He's been our colleague for the last 8 years. He's been working with us. There have been no problems. So he's trying to do all of these other kinds of moves to explain himself that, okay, sure, maybe I don't, my name doesn't fit exactly on this form, or the documents that you received, they didn't have a stamp, or they weren't directly postmarked from my medical school, but you got them, but the delivery route was a little bit different. But I'm supplementing all of this with these other forms of evidence. And they were just completely ignored. And the director of the hospital said, basically, I can't trust that what you're saying is true. And so he was denied hospital privileges and was not able to start his practice like he wanted to.
That is an amazing story. Well, amazing in that it's very insightful. In the earlier part of our interview, I introduced two local doctors here in Southern Oregon, Dr. Som Ghosh and Dr. Mujahid Rizvi. Let's listen to them describe their experiences navigating the immigration system. Then I'll get your response to each. We'll start with Dr. Ghosh.
So let's talk about the immigration process. I did have a chance to read the book. You know, and the book references the 60s and the 70s a whole lot. That was when the Hart-Celler Act of 1965 was passed, and that's when you got the first wave of immigrant physicians. A lot has changed since then. The whole immigration process has been streamlined, so it is not as much of a struggle as it was back then. But that being said, especially for physicians of Indian origin, it still is a challenge because the wait times are exceedingly long because of a bottleneck created in the early 2000s by other sectors. But that's a whole different conversation.
So, Dr. Alam, when he says other sectors are creating a bottleneck, do you know what he's referring to?
I think so. I think he's talking about the tech sector, and he's likely referring to the fact that one of the visa routes, which is the H-1B visa route that has been extremely politicized recently in the news, became the dominant route for tech workers. So this is a visa that is for skilled immigrants to come to the United States, and 70% of the tech workers that come to the United States are of Indian origin, and they became so highly sought after by Silicon Valley and really came to dominate that H-1B visa landscape.
My guest is Dr. Iram Alam, assistant professor in the History of Science Department at Harvard University. She's the author of The Care of Foreigners, How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare. Dr. Alam, let's hear from Dr. Rizvi, and we'll get your thoughts on the other side.
So probably pretty similar to Dr. Ghosh. You know, I think, you know, there are two parts to an immigrant physician's challenges. One is you're navigating the immigration process, the visa process, the green card, the U.S. citizenship process. And then the second part is just kind of going through your training, you know, which is hard in itself. You know, I initially came as a student, and then my visa changed to become a physician or a resident physician, and then eventually got an H-1 visa to work here in Southern Oregon. Each step had its challenges, and you kind of have to go through the process of going to U.S. Embassy. Sometimes you have to fly to Canada to get your passport stamped. So yes, there were challenges, but for the most part, achievable. You know, if you have legal help, they help you navigate through that process.
So Dr. Alam, he's talking about having a need for legal help. He's talking about having to travel to Canada. This is quite an extensive process for these very skilled, highly skilled, and much needed professionals.
I think this has always been the irony that many immigrant physicians have experienced. And so certainly the example that I talk about, the historical example of that first cohort, I think really exemplifies this, where there's this feeling of, you need us, we're filling the shortage, yet you're making this very, very difficult to navigate, when in fact what we're doing is providing a service that, again, is desperately needed in this country. And, you know, I also want to just think about Dr. Rizvi's comment about the clinic, because I think that within that space as well, there's this whole level of tacit knowledge or a hidden curriculum that physicians often have to absorb and be comfortable with, that it's not just about scientific or biomedical knowledge that they have to learn. It's this whole other cultural and social landscape as well.
Tell me what you call brand placement. What is that?
So I make an argument in the book that through this migration, what happened was there was an emergence of the South Asian physician in particular as a brand. And politicians started to recognize this. And so they became very familiar and friendly with the South Asian physician community because they saw them as a source for their campaigns to provide donations. And then I make an argument that once that cohered into a recognizable identity in the United States, that it was allowed to migrate into other more popular cultural spaces. And this is now second generation. So part of the argument that I make is this brand is consolidated around the form of the South Asian physician, and in it are first generation, second generation, but all of them have this identity of being a physician. So I look at Mindy Lahiri in the Mindy Lahiri Show, for example, who is the first South Asian person to be represented on network television. And she had a show for 6 seasons in which she plays an OBGYN who is, you know, working in New York City. And so I don't think that's a mistake, that that's the most first time that a lead in a sitcom is somebody with this particular configuration. And we see this in other figures, in people like Sanjay Gupta, who was the CNN medical correspondent, Vivek Murthy, who was the Surgeon General twice, Ashish Jha, who was one of the COVID White House coordinators, Atul Gawande, a really prominent physician who's a writer, who's comments and writes for The New Yorker. All of these people are able to exist within US public spaces, I think, because they are physicians. And I think this is especially important. We live in a moment where xenophobia is rampant, where fear of people who are non-white is completely normalized and pervasive. The figure of the terrorist is ubiquitous. Yet, nevertheless, there is some way that the South Asian physician is absolved from this kind of rhetoric. And I think it's through this care work that's mitigated their foreignness and has allowed them to emerge into these public spaces.
Well, we have only about 90 seconds left, and I have a really important question. Unlike many of the other immigrant groups, these physicians that you talk about represent a form of elite migration with significant economic capital. How do they use this influence to lobby the U.S. government and fight systemic discrimination?
I think it's complicated, and, you know, especially now, there are a lot of very diverse interests that people pursue. Historically, there was a time where there was more of a coherence and coalition building with the immigrant physicians that I study. In the 1980s, these physicians really came together and politically organized with other immigrant physician groups to work together to lobby Congress so that they could have at least the same requirements as their U.S. trained physicians in terms of exams, for example. This became something that they thought, okay, well, at least if we have equity in terms of the exams that we take, that people can't discriminate based on that. So really what they were trying to do is to raise awareness about the fact that they were experiencing in the workplace, people were rejected from positions that they were qualified for reasons that they were, and I can quote, that they were born in the wrong country, or that they didn't, their professors in India or Pakistan didn't have the right things on their CVs. And so they really tried to convince Congress that they had the same skills as their US trained physicians. And so that was where they started to spend their energy. And now I think the interests have diverged and gone to a lot of different places.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave that right there. Your book is fascinating, and the history is insightful. Thank you so much, Dr. Alam.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation.
My guest was Dr. Iram Alam, author of The Care of Foreigners, How Immigrant Physicians Changed U.S. Healthcare. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.